Welcome to the No Direction Podcast, PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage. Remember, we con when you can't.
Official.
All right,
whole hierarchy structured.
That means I'm in. All right, it's 10 o'clock. We'll do this. Start it. All right, so this is the Wayfinder panel, Gateway to the Industry. Is that what we called it?
Yeah, something like that.
Gateway to the Industry. This today we're going to go over kind of, number one, how Wayfinder kind of started, because it's an interesting story that only I'm interested in. So then we'll go through the process of kind of how we put it together, give you some insights on where contributors come into play, where editors were. Basically, it's a volunteer effort, so you'll get to see how all the volunteer effort kind of goes into play when we try to put this together. And then we'll, along the way, we will probably be talking a lot about specific things that might help you understand what we're looking for, or what we do when you do your contribution, kind of what your role is and what we're looking for. A lot of people writing articles, we have a lot of helpful tips. Mostly it's tied to the guidelines that we think everybody should read. But we have a lot of things we look for, and we'll impart that as much as we can. And then I really want to open it up, and I'll try to keep an eye to give us lots of time to have you ask questions. And if we're into something particular, you're kind of poking me.
Yeah, if you go long.
Excuse me, you and poke you when it's time for questions.
Okay. But if there's something relevant as we're talking and you want to shout out a question, I think we're probably good with that, too.
Yeah. So. Yes.
Okay.
Maybe since Tim's the only one with the name tag, you should probably introduce
him. Oh, God, yeah.
Okay, so we're going to go. So I'm Tim Nightingale. I am known as the founder of PaizoCon. I also always want to acknowledge that I actually had a co-founder, Liz Quartz. Couldn't have done it without her. Otherwise, the programming for that first one would have been, hey, we're all in the room. Who are you? So she did a lot of programming in that. So we're kind of the co-dictators of that. I also am the editor-in-chief of Wayfinder. I have been the editor-in-chief since issue number 5. Before that, it was Liz Quartz and Hugo Solis who started the magazine. And I took it over at 15 for purposes we'll get into when I talk about the history. But I've been kind of the steady person on board, along with Dane Nielsen, who does our layout. And then I've had a nice stream of volunteer helpers that have kept me sane and kept me doing it. So we'll go to our current.
I am Kalina Conrad. I am one of the current co-assistant editors-in-chief. Probably the easiest way to say it.
That's definitely the correct title. Co-assistant editor-in-chief.
Yeah. Good. And most of my purview deals with editors. I'm primarily editor, wrangler, and that kind of thing.
I'm Eric Hindley. I'm the other co-assistant editor-in-chief. That's not a mouthful of a title at all. Yeah, I do stuff for Wayfinder.
He does whatever I can't do or don't have time for.
They're really a good team, because Kalina has a busy schedule. Eric usually steps in when she's not available, so it's nice dynamic.
Yeah.
And
we pass off back and forth a lot.
They're kind of in one entity.
Yes.
For us. So. Okay. Well, I kind of got into a little bit of the history ahead of time, but so basically when I was doing PaizoCon, we'd done the first one, and it was a big success, and everyone was like automatically going to do PaizoCon 2. So we actually started developing that, getting the wheels turning on PaizoCon 2. And then Paizo came to me and said, you know, we really enjoyed ourselves at the first one, and we'd like to go ahead and start running these ourselves. Is that okay? And I was like, yes, you can totally do that. But they said that we're going to announce that, but for now, let's just act like you're still doing it, and then we'll try out the big announcement later. And so I was getting a lot of people wanting to get involved with PaizoCon too, and asking me specifically to do things or what the plan was. And I was like, oh, big plans on the horizon. Oh, we'll let you know when it all solidifies. Big things in the work. And I have to keep doing that until Paizo actually released their their big announcement, which was like January. So I actually had like months that I was basically just blowing people off. And one of the people I was blowing off was Hugo Solis, who's actually on this cover. He's this butterfrog right here. He's kind of, he's a graphic designer in Mexico, and he came to me and said, I want to do a program guide that's more like a fanzine of a way. It has a lot of stuff written by fans and art by fans, and we can populate it and put it in the program. And I'd really like to do that. Well, Paizo's taken the helm on this, and I'm sure they have their own idea for what a program guide is supposed to look like. So I kind of like think, well, that's nice, but I think we have the program guide thing underhand. There's some stuff going on. But you're talking about a fanzine, and that's a little more dynamic than a program guide. And luckily, I know someone who does fanzines, and that's Liz Quartz. You should probably talk to her. So we actually, has anybody been on the unofficial chat room, the DM Tools? Blank stares. So DM Tools is like an actual live kind of chat room thing that's, that Liz set up. That people from the message boards go and they do live chats. And James Jacobs used to go there on Tuesdays and you could ask him anything. We met in a private chat room, me, Hugo, and Liz, and we were chatting stuff out about what this might look like. And I kind of, he was introducing them, I planted a couple seeds saying, you know, it really, this Pathfinder Society thing is pretty new. It'd be really cool if this was like letters from the field kind of magazine, you know, people reporting in on places and things and monsters and creatures like Pathfinders would. And they were like, oh, that's pretty cool, you know. And I kind of left it at that. I was like, so you guys are good on that. And then, so for the PaizoCon 2, Hugo had and Liz had developed this magazine, and they actually, Hugo printed it because his family was a had a printing press in Mexico. And so he printed them super cheap. And he brought up like 300. And we handed them out for free. And I was astounded at just how awesome it looked. And that became a tradition. So every year, Hugo would develop that, and he would bring free copies. So fast forward to Wayfinder 4. Liz had gotten up to issue number 4, and then she got a job with Paizo. Now, handling finances and for a fan product and working for Paizo is a conflict, so she had to not do it. But she didn't know who else to hand it off to. Given that we had started PaizoCon together, she came to me and basically tricked me into actually taking over. She wasn't really clear on what I was doing and said it was really super easy, and then suddenly I was like thrust into it in spring of 2011, I think. We had not even put out the call for submissions, and because she had just finished 4, and so we had an open call of like maybe 2 months, and then we had to just pound this thing out so it was done by June or July, and so that was like a trial by fire for me. I had Liz with me and stuff, but she was willing to stay on for that issue to help me get my bearings, but after that, it was kind of, I found Dane Nielsen, he volunteered to help out, and together we kind of learned how to put together a magazine with a little bit of input from Liz. And we've just been carrying on since number 5 and number 6. And Liz told me when it started, it's like, it's usually like a 4 issues and out, because you'll get burned out and, you know, not turn it off or whatever. Yeah, I'm not a clever man.
So you tripled that time.
I kind of so did. I have like 13 of them under my belt now, and I really enjoy it. I actually have taken on more and more responsibility. Hugo had to drop out of the effort, so I kind of took on the art direction, which actually has turned out to be my passion for this magazine. And also along the way, it went from being a community kind of project to the gateway to the industry. We started to see that a lot of people were paying attention to this magazine that we actually really didn't. We thought it was just going to be accepted like a fanzine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, fanzines don't have a very good reputation for the most part for high quality content or even production. But people started to really pay attention to it. And Paizo started, the developers and the writers at Paizo started to like recommend that you write for Wayfinder because they read it and they look for talent there. And suddenly it became more than just our little pet project, a little hobby thing. It became a mechanism for people to learn how the industry works, kind of how freelancers operate. A little less stressful environment, but when you're getting your big break in doing this, it's kind of, you don't really know what's going on. You kind of do need to be eased into it and sort of shown the whole process. So we kind of, it was around issue number six or seven, I think around issue number seven, where I started to realize that this meant more to people than I thought it did. And that I really needed to start shifting the way I thought about it as my pet project, that I got to hang out and do stuff with great, cool people. And start to treat it as a serious, more seriously, because people were taking it more seriously than I had expected. So our mission kind of changed, at least in my mind, that instead of being this cool little project that was community-wise, it was a good tied the community together pretty well, to something that really was going to help people and get them into the industry and get Paizo and third-party publishers a lot more candidates to use.
I was surprised when I first got involved how many, especially third-party publishers, considered Wayfinder to be an actual writing credit. You think about a fanzine, a lot of publishers are like, oh yeah, you wrote for a fanzine, whatever, they take anything. But the people who were like, oh, you've been published in Wayfinder, oh, that's, you know, like, which was kind of amazing.
Yeah, it was just, and I had third-party publishers coming to me and saying, who did the art for this? Can you share that information with me? And so I would sit down with Wolfgang Bauer or Jason Nelson and actually share. We would go through the magazine and he would say, who's this? And I'd say, oh, it's a so-and-so. And he's like, I really like them.
Yeah. You're like, I can read the credits. Come on, guys.
It's not only,
no,
it's,
I know.
Yeah, it's not only that, but they would come to me and say, so who, it was really,
what else have they done?
It was like, who's great? Yeah. Who should we be looking at? And that was really weird for me because, you know, these are people who are, you know, Wolfgang Bauer is kind of my hero. He's going to read, he's going to hear that. And think, oh my God. But I mean, I really, Cobalt Quarterly was before this. And that was really the high benchmark for me. It was like, he's putting out a magazine that's just covering a lot of stuff. And he's doing it really super well. And it's, you know, that's a magazine. It's, you know, Dungeon and Dragon magazine, also the benchmark. But he continued that so we're kind of trying to emulate that a little bit, trying to learn the process. He's done, you know, but we're not professional. And that's, I keep saying, we're not professionally running a magazine. I'm not doing it for money. I don't have a company. This is what we're emulating. So when they closed down and he did in a blog post that we're kind of the success, we're now the successor, this is now the magazine that has the Pathfinder content. It was kind of, that was another blow that was like, oh my God, now we have to be serious about this. So, following a lot of people's footsteps, learning a lot of things along the way. But it has definitely morphed into something that warrants, like, this is probably the biggest seminar I've had when I've done Wayfinder stuff. So I'm really happy to see everybody here.
So, was that a question?
Yeah, I remember around the time that issue 16 was coming out, a post on your Facebook page that you were, I don't know if it was discouraged or not, but it went something along the lines of, please tell me that it's not just the contributors and such that are downloading this. Do you have any kind of updated data or like download totals, how many total in circulation, essentially kind of anything about like how much is Wayfinder really out there, how widely is it?
So I can tell you that for a while, for the contributor, when you're doing a contributor or a consignment, there's a consignment tool in Paizo that you're uploading this stuff, and you can go and look at your stock and how much, and it used to have that you could see the entire history. At some point that broke and they're trying to fix it, so I didn't get entire information. I can see within 3 month window of what's happening. But when I could see the entire thing, and that was up to Wayfinder 12 or 13, Yeah, we had over 100,000 unique downloads for the entire line. And it was going from, you know, Wayfinder 1 had the most, and it would just kind of trickle down. So Wayfinder 1 had been downloaded over 50,000 times. So it was encouraging. I know people were downloading it. I know people weren't downloading like six times, but each. But so I knew that there, you know, I knew that that was it. But it was. It's also a barometer for me to see reviews, to get a sense of who likes it and if we're doing the right thing. If we kind of did a step back and it was not as good as the previous one, you know, we always want to get a sort of a barometer of where you are and what, whether you've made the right move. The for this issue, and or you've made a misstep, and don't do that ever again. And you really can track that with downloads, because if there's not a lot of interest and people aren't really downloading, you can get a sense of like, well, that theme didn't work. Nobody's interested in Osiria, you know. That's not true. But yeah, it was giving us a barometer. So when I lost that tool, it was kind of like, I have no idea who's downloading this. And so it's encouraging to hear from a greater audience. And, you know, everybody likes to have input. I know me personally, I want to hear people's input and I like to see reviews. But I know that every person that contributed to this, writers, they really want to know if they're writing, if people enjoy their writing. And so the bad thing about reviews and getting feedback is that you usually don't get positive feedback. Because if people are happy, they're not going to complain. They don't feel like they want to post, I'm happy, I'm content, I don't need to do that. If they're unhappy, well, that's a different story. They want to tell you all about it. So So it's kind of one of those things where, like, well, if I'm not hearing anything, I have to assume that everybody's happy. Because if they weren't, then I would be hearing it in droves, sort of thing.
Well, as you were saying yesterday, I guess because we hand them out at the beginning during registration. And I guess yesterday afternoon and evening, there were people coming to the table saying, oh, I didn't get my Wayfinder. Can I get my Wayfinder? So the fact that people at the con are asking for it, it's not just something that we're forcing on people.
Right.
Take this!
I mean, we do that, too.
Take it! Take it!
So did you see lower downloads for the printed ones? Hopefully that was a reason they were lower
downloads? No, it's usually the PaizoCon issues are way higher in demand. The winter issues are less, because honestly, and then that also deals with contributors. A lot of people want to be more involved with that print issue than the one that's just PDF only.
They can have something in their hands.
So, and that was one of the decisions that was a really a factor in why we decided to go down to one. Because, you know, we can get into our reasons for that later.
Will they all be printed then now?
They will all be PaizoCon.
They're all PaizoCon issues. So, so there, you got the history.
No.
You want to, so I did my part. You said you were going to do the rest of it.
I remember that.
Well, you were really inspired. Well, I'll just go ahead and do so,
No, it's fine.
The process really is, it's evolved over time, and we've gotten a lot better with organization and how we do things.
Yeah. Our current process.
Yeah.
Because I can't really speak to previous processes.
No, we were going to go with the current process. There's no reason dwelling on what we don't do anymore.
Yeah. They don't need to know what we don't do. Does anyone need to know what we don't do?
All right. So our current process is changing a little bit for this next issue because we are going down to one. But it's only changing in that we have more time for all the phases. All the phases are still there. They're just a little more relaxed. They were not on the last issue. So our first phase, obviously, is selecting a theme. Usually we select a theme as soon as the current issue is in production, in like once it goes to, once we pick the articles almost, we're already talking about the next theme. Theme selection is, it kind of depends. Like if Paizo is releasing something that we want to tie into, then there's that.
Has released something.
Or, yes, sorry, has released something.
Because the problem is with a theme is we don't want to do, for example, Starfinder right now.
Yeah.
Because nobody has any Starfinder stuff.
Right.
Yeah. And so, we don't want to step on their toes constantly.
And importantly, Paizo hasn't developed it fully. Yeah. So if, and I have to remind people, Wayfinder 1 came out after Rise of the Rune Lords and the campaign setting had been produced, and they were producing more content along the way. So there was something to write to. And the risk of doing something that's in the process or brand new, or you really have to get it, and I do talk with Paizo about, so if we did this, I try to get feedback a little bit about how risky is this theme in terms of this element? Are you done with it? Because the issue is that if we start writing to something that Paizo has plans to develop, then everything we write gets written or gets overruled. So it doesn't matter how cool your barbarian, Ulfden barbarian was. Lands of the Lindorm Kings is completely wiped that clean. All the stuff that you wrote about Lindorms and all that stuff. Paizo now has a supplement that completely spells all that out, and it conflicts with what you've just written. So people aren't going to be as excited because they're going for the official thing. It might be a cool concept, but people tend to go with the official stuff. And that third-party publishers don't get to write to the IP. So they don't ever have a conflict because they're writing rules that are supplemental or complementary to Pathfinder. Whereas we are writing in the world. So we kind of have to not violate canon, and we have to be smart about what theme we pick and what we're writing about because of that risk factor that if Paizo's not done with it, then we have the risk of being obsolete. And case in point, Land of the Lindorm Kings, issue number 6, we had planned, they said, the schedule said it's coming out. We thought, oh, it'll come out. It'll be all this new information. People get really super inspired, and they'll have something brand new that's really, really invigorating them to write to Land of the Lindorm Kings. Well, that was late. And it actually came out a couple weeks before the call closed. And so very few people got a chance to look at it. And I actually got an advanced copy because our call closed. And I went through and read the Land of Lindorm Kings supplement and then read the ones we picked and then emailed those people saying, I found a conflict. I think we can resolve it, but this is what it's going to have to be. And actually was sort of like typing in, this is what the supplement says. Are you okay with changing it to fit that? And that was a lot of extra work, and I really don't want to ever have to do that.
Well, and it's harsh on authors, too, because, right. You know, you get excited, you write your thing, and then you get told, oh, you can't write that, it steps all over.
Right. So like. We try to get something that, like, if an AP is now on the shelf and a little bit older, we know that it's kind of been done. You know, it's on the shelf, it's sitting there. In fact, I like to pick APs that actually are older because people have forgotten about them. Because one of the things is that the player base is constantly new. You know, Pathfinder is always bringing in new players, and the AP that's current in flavor is current, and that's what they're doing, and they're not looking back to, you know, Curse of the Crimson Throne. So if we, you know, if that one's collecting dust and hasn't gotten people forgotten about it, it's really great to go ahead and look at the region that it was in, that AP was involved with, named that as the theme, and then suddenly people are going back and looking, oh, there's all this new content that fits that AP that I have never played and I don't have, so it sort of reinvigorates that AP as an interest base. It's like people, I don't want people to forget about the good stuff that has been done. So we kind of work, it works both ways. I try to help Paizo out a little bit by, you know, picking a theme that people will go back and look at. And we also want to make sure that we're not jumping the gun and writing stuff that is they're not done with yet.
And of course, it has to be something we think, A, people want to write about, and B, people want to read and use the content. I mean, the whole goal of this, ideally, is that people are like, oh, that's cool, I'm going to use that in my game. So, you know, there's a lot of things that go into picking a theme. So that's usually, as I said, the first thing we do before the last issue is even finished. So that we can put the call out. Like right now, there's a call out for First World for October. End of October.
Fae the First World by the end of October.
Yeah.
Halloween.
There you go. Fae for Halloween. So then we put out the announcement for the call. And we accept submissions. Sometimes we'll get submissions coming in like the first or second day. And then it usually dies off for a while, and then towards the end we start to see like 20 submissions a day, sometimes.
Right. And then 80 on the last day.
Yeah, and then 80 on the last day. It's kind of how it works.
Yeah, and they've warned me never to, so I get a little nervous.
A little nervous, is that what you get to?
So I watch, I keep tabs of what's coming in. We download them, we track them, we put them in a spreadsheet in Google Docs to log them in so we can start to see the types and who's writing.
Yeah.
And so we can kind of keep track of, you know, what the balance of what's coming in. So I can get a good idea of how this issue is going to go. And I get really nervous when we're a week out and we have like 30.
Yeah.
And we need a minimum of 45 to make a magazine, right? So I get like, oh my God, this is what's going on. And so I kind of freak out and like, and I put, only have 35. This isn't looking good, folks. And then like.
The next day.
Just and then you know, within the last 3 days, we get like 100.
Yeah, you know, I keep telling him. It's okay.
Because people really rally to that, so I sort of need to shut up.
Well, and on the last one, you did do some, like, midway, and I think with this newer one, it's probably a good idea. Like, midway being like, hey, just, you know, call's still open. You know, coming up in October.
Updates you do are really useful. Like, here's, you have, you know, whatever, 10 bestiary items, but
right.
Two magic items. You know, I don't find that really helpful.
See, and on that point, we would rather have too many magic items or too many bestiary entries if they're all really good, rather than have somebody go, oh, they don't have any fiction, or oh, they don't have any...
Or oh, they have too many bestiary items I'm not going to submit.
Right. Like, so we've had a lot of discussion about this. So one of the common things during our call is people start to say, what do you need? You know, I want to write to what you need. And honestly, I get that, and I appreciate it, and that's why I put the tallies out and stuff. The tallies are a lot of work. I'm just telling you, it's like me having to really pay attention, and that's fine. I should do that. But
reading Tim actually read these articles as they come in.
But the thing I'd rather you do is write to what you want to write, not to what I need you to write. I mean, that does come into play later on with freelancing, is that you get asked that a lot. And maybe some of the freelancers are actually, that's what they're comfortable with in asking it. But I would rather you write to something that inspires you. Something that you know, a lot of people have something very specific, like, there's this class that I've always wanted to do, and I've never seen it, and I think it's unique, and I think people would enjoy it. That inspires you. You should write it. I want you to write what you want to write, not what I want you to write. So that's my first, that should be your first priority, is write what inspires you and what is going to make this submission that you're giving me 100% you. This is your vision for what you want to show off. Because this is really, if you get in this magazine, this is what all the third-party publishers in Paizo, these are the people that are going to look at this and make a judgment on your writing abilities and your imagination and what you can do. So I want you to bring your best game to the table. I mean, I really want you to do that. That said, I understand when some people are really dynamic and just can write to anything. And I try to do the tallies kind of as a personal exercise, so I know where the gaps are, but I can tell you 100% where the gaps are, because they're there every issue. I have to beg for gazetteers, because people love to write classes and crunch stuff. And we get a lot of that. And I actually get more class stuff and more Wheeler woes than anything else. Because people want to write the stat block. People want to do bestiary stuff. People want to do class development and class skills. That also includes archetypes and for bards performance stuff. So it's any mechanism or mechanics that are class dependent. They're basically developing a class skill or you know, those sorts of things. But gazetteers are usually a kind of a hole, because that's more of a campaign setting, more flavor text.
But don't underestimate the value of a cool location.
Those tend to be, and this is the reason why I like them. Paizo, if you ever go into the Inner Sea World Guide, you know, they leave tons of little hooks. So if you read through a country, they name places and put them on the maps. There's places on the maps that there is nothing written except one sentence. And you're just like, oh my God, that sounds really interesting. Paizo's never going to develop that. I've actually talked to a couple places, and they're like, oh, yeah, that's, we write, you know, that's the whole thing, you write a little tag, and that is a hook for people to, I want to develop my own thing for that. So this is an opportunity to look at that entire palette and all those little Easter eggs and hooks and all that stuff and just pick it out and make it your own. And but actually show Paizo, who put one line in there, that somebody ran with that. And so you can write to their world. And that's good proof that you get it. So Gazetteers, it's always, I'm always wanting more Gazetteers and more, you know, location driven articles about interesting people that you find there, you know, just all that.
You get some cool maps out of
that. Yeah, and we get great maps out of that too.
Yeah.
Magic items, always need magic items. I mean, usually I usually say that at the end, it's like not enough magic items. And we've actually that's changed over the time. We used to be able to just have articles on them. But then we found out that the magic items are a lot like the bestiary. A lot of people just want to write one or two magic items. That's not enough to make an article. But if enough people write one or two magic items, and they're pretty good, we can put them into what we call the Hero's Hoard, which is basically a bestiary of magic items. So we can group them together, and sometimes we do like one where it's like a shop you'd go into, and here's all the weird stuff that you find. So we found that that's a really easy mechanism for people it's a way to adapt that people don't want to write a full 750, 1500 words on all these magic items. They've only got two in them. So they can submit that. We can pool them together and actually make a pretty cool article out of it and get a lot of people to contribute. Actually, that bestiaries and magic item consolidation articles usually have a lot more contributors. So we can pack a lot more people into the issue. To get a break.
On that topic, I would suggest to anybody who does contribute or wants to contribute the items, I've done both approaches that you're talking about, here's an item, here's a couple of items, versus getting enough to make a 750 or a 1500 word article. And I would suggest that if you haven't done that and you're just doing the item, try that, because it's a way to learn more. And I would say if you can do the items, why not try to hit that 750 or 1500.
See,
an intro, talk about the shop, just try it.
Yeah, you can try that. I would much rather see one or two really good magic items than half a page of text about a shop and one or two cool magic items and three or four mediocre magic items and maybe a feat because you still had 100 words at the end, and the whole thing just feels like I needed to hit word count.
We do cherry pick items from articles. So if you submit 750 words of two solid magic items and a not so solid one, we may choose the two solid ones and then, you know, set the other one aside. Right. That is something we have done.
Magic item, dedicated magic item ones where you're going to hit that 750 or the 1500. Only work if you have a theme. So if that article has a theme of this is the type of magic item, it's tied to a rune lord, so these are all magic items that are...
Or like a love potion shop or something.
Yeah,
like
or a love potion shop, or this is...
Magic scarves.
Yeah.
It's my first Wayfinder article.
So it's just if you have a theme that all of your magic items fit that theme, they're all that type. And they can be different things, but they're all tied to some central idea. Those it ties together. It's a more solid article if you have an overriding.
We're less likely to break those up.
Right. But if it's kind of a hodgepodge, that's always the worst thing is that they have, it's supposed to be like a race. And then the race has a whole bunch of, has some magic items that race might use. And then a couple feats that are only unique. So it's like this hodgepodge of everything. It was just supposed to be a race, and it's a race plus a whole bunch of other stuff. And you really get a sense of they got this far with the race, and then they had word count, and they just start throwing extra stuff in. And that, it's a little infuriating because when I'm trying to type it and like what type of article this is, and it's like two different types, it's that thing of like, well, what exactly do I have here? Do I have a class, or do I have a race, or do I have magic items? I have all three. That's really weird. So, you had a question.
So, going on with that theme, If we go ahead and make a magic item, and I'll come up with a background story of the creation of the magic item instead of an end how it developed, would that be something you're looking for to say, like, it could become a magic item that was made because of a necessity that needed to be filled? And so a little background story of why it was created, who was using it, and that kind of thing. Would that be something that
So the way that works is it only works if it's like a if it's a major plot driven, like you can build an entire adventure around that.
So like
and it should
like
be an artifact at that
like
that
point. Like what wilderness survival tool they were using and how that developed.
So if a magic item for wilderness survival, for example, gives you it should be pretty obvious why it was developed.
Right.
If it's a pair of boots that, you know, it's the boots of the Winterlands, and it gives you a bonus against cold, and you don't leave footprints in the snow, I don't need to know that that's because the tribe kept getting eaten by wolves, so they developed these boots so that the wolves couldn't find them.
Yeah.
It should be pretty obvious from the actual design of the magic item why it was built.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Anything with an actual full backstory is probably an artifact.
It's an artifact, and it's an artifact that you could build an entire adventure or some major sidetrack on.
One of the big things that always came up in RPG Superstar was magic items don't have backstories. You don't. If you flip your core rulebook open and look through the magic items section, there is not a single one in there with a backstory. Not one.
I thought the current one, which I co-wrote with Isabel, but she really did all the work on Weapons of Sin.
Yeah.
You know, that was almost, like, I came up with the core item, these Weapons of Sin, but she did, like, the perfect amount of backstory.
Yep.
Like,
well, in a case where you have a themed article with multiple items, a little bit of backstory helps, right? Because it helps establish the theme and the cohesion of the items.
Right.
So, in that case, a couple of paragraphs of, like, you know, the scarves in Varizia, people love scarves, and so they've developed a use of something that they use every day, like that kind of in that kind of instance. Yeah, it ties it together really nice.
Right, and there's one that we had that were ones to kill giants. It was the monster one, I think. That had like you know, cyclopean, the cyclops killers, and giant killers, and you know, they were all tied together. These are weapons that you use to kill gigantic creatures that are humanoid. So it could be pretty loose, but it, I mean, there's a common tied theme, but really, that if you're going to do that, a huge proportion of that article should be your magic items, and not necessarily the backstory. You know, a good, if it's a big themed one, I would say a quarter of it should be an intro, and then the rest of it should be the magic items, because that's your thing. Unless, like I said, you're trying to develop more of a side story thing. So...
So
how far along
we're getting there.
We're getting there.
We're
almost filled the time.
Can I get you to talk a bit about the art process?
Sure. That's so yeah. We're talking about all writing, but
art
is my passion. Yes,
I just want to say one to wrap up this whole thing about article submission. He mentioned a spreadsheet that we use. So every article that comes in, just to wrap up that step of the process. Is every article comes in, all three of us read everything that comes in. The spreadsheet has all of the information, and then each of us puts our comments, and then we have usually a FaceTime discussion or a Skype discussion for 3 hours, where we talk about every single article and the merits and the drawbacks, and we basically, that's how we pick which ones get in, is we all read them independently, we form our own opinions, and then we discuss them all together, and we pick, based on obviously filling the magazine, but also that's usually has never been a problem. But we do discuss things like, okay, well, it's a bit rough, but I think we can make this work. I think we can work with the author on this one. I think we can. So it's not always, you know, it has to be perfect before you submit it to us. A lot of things are not perfect when we get them, but if they have the seed to be perfect, and part of my job as the editor wrangler, is I have to look at it and say, is this something I think that my team of editors and myself could develop to a point where it's good to be published?
Right. So there's two elements to the submission, really. It's the concept and the execution.
Yeah.
So those are judged together somewhat, but I have picked many that have had a really strong concept, but the execution's been shaky. But because I know that concept is like, oh my God, that is a great idea. We can make that better. There was one that was games at the Swallowtail Festival.
Oh,
you could put it at the beginning of Rise of the Rune Lords. And there were a bunch of little carnival games. And, you know, it was shakily written. The style was kind of like, I just don't know what the heck. But and even the editor that looked at it was like, this is a mess. You should just throw this out. This is too much work. And I'm like, no, this is a thing that can happen at the beginning of Rise of the Rune Lords that's all introduces how to do skill checks. This is perfect for people starting. This is a festival concept. That's almost glossed over because the goblins come in and kill everybody. You know, it's like let's make the festival. So I mean, this is a thing.
Spoilers, Tim. Ruin the first encounter of Rise of the Rune Lords.
So anyway, that I just wanted to wrap up that one.
Yeah, but I mean, so it's concept and execution, and I think a strong concept that's very unique is a winner, and execution only happens if you can't follow guidelines. I mean, really, it comes down to if you massively violated the guidelines, like you've given me 1,100 words when I asked you for 1,500 or 750. There's nothing I can do. If it's right in between, I can't cut and I can't add. So that is a
well,
you know, you violated canon. You put something in completely unrelated that, you know, Aragorn's alive. So
and here's where he's been.
Yeah, so you can't do that. I mean, we have guidelines, and I strongly suggest everybody really become familiar with them and write to the guidelines in our
And I will be honest and say that I've occasionally had to play the bad guy, especially when we end up on a short timeline like this last issue, where I have to look at it, because all of our editors are volunteers too. And I have to look at it and go, yes, there is a really great concept here, but this is more work than we have time for on this issue. One of the exciting things about expanding our timeline and only doing one issue is that it means we have a lot more time to work with authors and develop stuff that is a little bit... that is awesome, but isn't quite there. We have a lot more time and ability to pick those and develop those, which is kind of exciting.
So about that art, Tim?
Yeah.
Okay. So for the art process, what I do is I build a roster. So if you are an artist and you are interested in illustrating for Waylander, it is an entire volunteer sort of effort, so you don't get paid for it. I've had some artists that come in and say, no, it's your rate. Hey, and I'm like, this is volunteer. You do this because you want to contribute, not because you want to make money on it. I don't even get paid. So we have a roster. Sometimes I go out and ask people if they want to be on it. Other times I get contacted. But if you want to be on it, you contact wayfinder.fanzine@gmail.com. And you send me a link to your DeviantArt or your gallery or someplace online that shows me your artwork. So I can see all your abilities across the spectrum of what you do. And I can look at it and get a sense of your style. If I think that your ability and your style and what your content looks like fits in with our theme and what the rest of the artists, because we've started to creep up on a level that looks fairly professional. And a lot of people are there. They're there and they don't have the exposure. They've been drawing for fun and they're absolutely awesome, but they haven't promoted themselves. They have no place to put that art out except they're hidden in DeviantArt along with thousands of other artists that maybe will get featured, you know, on their feature page. So a lot of people will be interested, and if we think that it's a good fit and that, you know, we definitely, if I'm really impressed, I'll add you to the roster. Then what happens is when we close the call for submissions and we start to pick out the articles, I know we're going that way, I will activate the roster. I will send out an email to everybody and say, we are starting the process. In the next few months, I will need art. Are you available? And if you're available, how many do you think you can do? How many pieces are you willing to pony up and say, I can do 3 pieces of this size or whatever. I'm willing to commit my time for this. And sometimes people want to say, I only have time for one. Some people say, I'm really busy with other freelance, you know, other commissions. I don't have time right now. It's fine. Activating the roster gives me an idea who's on deck, who wants to be involved with this issue.
And just sometimes, because you're busy for one issue doesn't mean
right,
you never talk to
you're
you.
You're always on it. Until you ask me that I'm no longer willing to be on your roster, I don't have time for Wayfinder anymore. You're always on it. Just constantly, I will activate the roster that I have, which is about 30 to 40 artists, and we'll put out the who's game. We're ready to start it. Once we pick the articles, I have articles to write art direction to. So what I will do is go through, and I will have the whole list, and I'll read the articles again. And and I will actually have like 30, 40 tabs open that are everybody's galleries. And I'll go through, I'll keep going through, and I'll read the article, and I'll be, okay, this is what's in my mind's eye. Who matches that? And I'll go through, and it'll be like maybe it's something that has a lot of a bird or something with wings. So I'll look for somebody who really does wings well, really does that kind of art, or has that in their gallery of like, oh yeah, that person can draw a griffin really well, and this is kind of griffin. Okay, there, yeah. So it's a lot of by feel of this person is perfect for this, and I think what I'm picturing in my head of what this should look like, they can meet that. And so I start making that assignment. I basically have another spreadsheet where I basically just start moving people's names around until all of the articles are filled. And we try to have every article have a piece of art. And every monster in the bestiary has a piece of art. So I can get like 60, there are around 60 pieces of art for every issue of Wayfinder. That's astounding. So I'll go through and I'll do that. And then I make the process of actually, I'll sort all the people, all the lists by artists. So I have all their assignments. And then I will sit down and I actually personally write out what I think they should, what I'd like to see them illustrate. It's completely customized. I've been told I should automate it somehow, but it's a way for me to personally say, this is what I think this should look like. But here's the extra step. The artists get the article. And I think that's crucial because I'm reading it, and I can tell you that. And I know a lot of third-party publishers and publishers, I know Paizo does, they have it all pre-designed. They have the art submission thing of what they want it to look like, and it goes out, and the artist is doing it while the person's writing it. You know, so there's rarely that connect. We benefit from actually having the articles, and so I share that with the artist. The artist gets the full benefit of seeing exactly what they're drawing to. And sometimes, and in most cases, they have better ideas than me. And it actually creates a dialogue, we have a conversation about, you know, this is what you were thinking. What if I did this? And some of the artists actually do three different concepts. So they'll read it, and then they'll have, here's your three choices. And then I get to pick, which is it's Christmas. And a lot of times, it's something from each one of them, you know. So it's more of a collaboration it's really, really good. And that's why I think the art just keeps continuing to get better, because we are now having conversations and being a team in developing what the art looks like. So that's really the process with art. It kind of goes that way. I try to give all artists at least 6 weeks to develop one or two pieces. Some are really ambitious and they just crank stuff out, and I'm just amazed every time. Some artists wait till the last day, and sometimes that shows. But I at least try to give 6 weeks. Now that we have a much more generous timeline that's less crunchy, it's probably 8 weeks. I always give the artists 8 weeks. It just really makes them relax. And I always ask for works of progress now, because that they can give me a little sketch, and then we can be on the same page, and no mistakes are made. You know, it's again a collaboration where I'm not surprised at the end of like, what the hell is this?
Well, and so, because we're all working digitally, we don't. This is one time a year we all get in the same room together. Mm-hmm. We live all over the world, and we're working with people all over the world. It lets us know you're still there, you're still alive, yes. Especially on a volunteer project, right? You're getting paid for it, there's a little more motivation for you to be there, but this mm-hmm. is a volunteer thing. And life happens, stuff comes up. But, you know, we're kind of sitting there in the dark like, oh, did this person, are they still alive? Did something happen? Like, you know, yeah. He was first.
Oh.
You said that you write up the art request after reading the article. You ever thought about having the author do that to save you some... 1,000 paragraphs every issue?
They could, but a lot of times they have a much more different. I've had actually some authors make their own art,
and I don't agree with that at all. It's like, no, I know that's what you're thinking, and that's helpful, but there's something much with it. For creatures, that might be one thing, but for like articles, and especially fiction or something, there are scenes or abilities, feats or something that I think would be much cooler. And I've actually disagreed with the authors when they actually see their, like, I thought this would have been cooler. It's like, that's nice. But and letting me do it, it basically ties all the art. I mean, everything has a level and a feel and a theme. So.
Well, and there's a certain format thing about that too, right? Yeah. Not new authors don't always know how to write an art request. And
okay, last question.
Yeah. So are all magazines planned to be color moving forward?
So there's the thing. We got a special deal this year, and because it was the 10-year PaizoCon, 10 years of Pathfinder, I was able to secure a pretty generous offer from the printer to print them in color.
Who prints them?
It's a local print shop called Hot Off the Press in Redmond. It's like nearby my house, and I know the people, and they're really nice. And they love printing this. This is the weirdest thing they can print, and they love it. Going forward, if we can raise enough money, because this is a volunteer effort, and I'll be honest, it's $4,500 we have to print, we have to raise every year to do this. If we can raise that, yeah, we'll do them in color as long as we can afford that. So that said, as we close this,
you can.
Yeah, I'll put on my pitch.
I have a quick part two on that. So, for artists, do you have like a pool of color artists?
It's all color.
Because the PDF is always available.
The PDF.
No, I'm saying so. Okay, so all working would be in color.
Yeah.
Regardless
yeah.
of the print.
Sometimes I have people in black and white, but then what usually happens is I get another artist to color it if that artist does not want to color it, or sure. areas doesn't have the capabilities of doing that at that point. It's not in their wheelhouse.
Yeah.
But and in some cases, black and white's fine. I mean, it depends on the article. If it's supposed to be an old school, crunchy kind of thing, black and white's awesome. But we try to go color. So yeah, thanks. My only other pitch is if you have been attending PaizoCon and you've enjoyed having free Wayfinders and it actually means something to you monetarily, we would really appreciate a donation. It really helps drive this forward so we can. So this is our new benchmark to start printing them in color every year. So.
All donations go straight towards printing.
Yep, absolutely. And we have a PayPal thing, and I can also take it personally. If that's your deal.
Just slip them up.
We have a PayPal thing that works for you as well. Thanks.
Is that getting admitted?
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for everything. And we're available for questions if you see us.
Pretty easy to find.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of the No Direction Podcast PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage, made possible with the help of Justin Sluder and Ryan Hiller of Geek Dad. To find more great Pathfinder audio, go to NoDirectionPodcast.com.